schools. She is an MA candidate in Spanish literature at BYU, and we'll hear from Catherine for 30 minutes. And then Professor Harold K. Moon, professor of Spanish at BYU, will respond for 15 minutes. He is a creative writer currently working on a novel about Mormon polygamy in Mexico. And there will be tapes of this session available outside in the lobby near the registration table.
I hope we have a little bit of latitude on the time division that you mentioned. Before I start, I would like to show you a copy of the facsimile version of the Book of Sparrows that I'm going to be talking about. It's a facsimile reproduction which was published in 1970 as a commemorative celebration of the centennial of Baker's death. And this is on loan from the Cornell Library. If you're at all interested in the translations, that's in the first portion. And here in the back portion is the book itself, the title page, Libro de los Gorriones, or Book of Sparrows, the symphonic introduction, the Stone Woman, all in Spanish, of course. And then you will see that there's an enormous skip of about 509 pages to the last part, which begins with words that say the index of the rhymes, or índice de las rimas, which will be what I'll be talking about mostly as an example of one way that romanticism. Okay. Romanticism moved toward silence. Keats might have died as young as he did had he not been a romantic poet. The Spanish writer Lara might have shot himself with or without his writing. It may have been Wordsworth's time to redo the prelude, though in many instances the first version rings truer to the music of English than the second. The early French romantic Chateaubriand may have ridiculed his early writing simply because he had matured. Coleridge could have burned out on drugs alone. Individuals who are not artists run amok, and artists have suffered disproportionate degrees of agony and ecstasy at times other than the late 18th and early 19th century, and have experienced varying degrees of artistic activity at different times of life. Before the advent of modern medicine, early death was common, and age usually tempers youthful idealism. Still, it is hard to escape the impression that romantic writers were wrestling with an angel who often won. Even more persuasive than reviewing romantic biography is perusing romantic progeny. First, the creatures the romantics created, their heroes, concluded their struggles in silence. Goethe's Werther and Don Alvaro, the creation of the Duque de Rivas, committed suicide. Chateaubriand's René was massacred by Indians after he lost all hope for earthly happiness. 19th century opera abounds with heroines who sing their last aria on a dying, usually consumptive breath. Second, many of the creators the romantics spawned, the writers who have followed them, have moved toward silence. For Mallarmé, the French poet, the perfect poem became the white, unsullied page. His Un coup de dé is mostly blank space. After beating his linguistic wings against English, Eliot concludes the exquisitely wrought agony of the wasteland in Sanskrit. Jeffrey Hartman, an American critic, speaks of the death of poetry as an accomplished fact. Would creative critics such as Roland Barthes and Paul de Man be treating their subject, literature, as poets have treated their subject, nature, if they had more faith in the future of poetry or even its current existence? Barthes, a French critic who's aware of the plight of writers of the last two centuries, comes to the conclusion that Voltaire could be a happy writer in part because he lived in an age which accepted evil as part of the work of a God who had created, then abandoned the world, and that therefore the writer could joust with society without feeling ultimately responsible for its ills. According to Barthes, Rousseau's postulate that man is naturally good and the evil in his nature derives from the corruption of society placed a permanent burden on the shoulders of the writer, who would forevermore feel obligated to correct society, and being unable to do so would suffer under the accumulated baggage of the woes he could not change. Yet the well-known initial romantic expression of hope and enthusiasm continues to present itself with such compelling force that it hovers like a white bird of imagination over many of the bleak scenes that followed. In his essay, Intentional Structure of the Romantic Image, de Man peers with penetrating insight into the matter and concludes that Hölderlin's simile comparing the origination of words to that of flowers is a basic statement of the romantic aesthetic. Now, therefore, must words originate like flowers. That is to say, the Romantics gave to words or wanted to give to words the status of natural objects, investing them with the nostalgia we feel for the natural object. De Man maintains that this misapprehension of the ontological nature of words has continued to derail poetry for nearly two centuries. He then suggests an antidote for the poetic sterility which has plagued many of the spiritual descendants of the Romantics and which he laments as the harbinger of the real and projected demise of poetry. He quotes from Rousseau, Wordsworth, and Hölderlin to illustrate a different kind of imagery which, had it become ascendant, would have averted the current dilemma in which poetry finds itself. De Man says that it's possible that the threatening paralysis that prevails among our own contemporaries and seems to grow with the depth of their poetic commitment may only be overcome when the status of poetic language, or more restrictively, of the poetic image, is again brought into question. De Man then suggests that we look to the early Romantics for a direction poetry could have taken by quoting Rousseau, Hölderlin, and Wordsworth. Of course, proposed solutions are by nature more difficult to elucidate than perceived problems. Still, it's hard to see any basic difference between the imagination that produced the rather sublime image of words that originate like flowers and the imagination that produced transcendent forays into the mountains where there are, and this is Wordsworth, stationary blasts of waterfalls, where nature, and this is Rousseau, reunited all the seasons in the same instant, and from Hölderlin, where there in the Alps it is still bright night. The flower image and the mountain images seem to portray the same sort of clash between nature itself and the desire to possess nature and transform it by the power of the trope into something new and different and startlingly unnatural. As De Man points out, it is evident in these passages that Wordsworth, Rousseau, and Hölderlin each resolve the tension skyward and achieve a moment of peace as they leave earth behind. But it may be that any more positive configuration they embody results from the fact that they are early Romantics. Early Romanticism in England and Germany partook of hope and enthusiasm. Wordsworth particularly saw great cause for optimism in the French Revolution. Later writers saw the disintegration of that revolution into the Reign of Terror. The French and Spanish had to endure Napoleon, and by the time Romanticism proper took root in Gallic and Castilian soil, the tension between early hopes and their grotesque realization pulled late Romantics into tortured positions as they grasped for what was rapidly slipping away. But it is far from certain that the early Romantics uncover a fundamentally new kind of relationship between nature and consciousness. Rather, if they are building on the same kind of intense, crackling imagery Hölderlin employs in comparing the origin of words to that of flowers, and if that imagery, as De Man maintains, is at the heart of the romantic misalignment, then no matter how high they climb, the moments of resolution can never be stable. Those who construct their ladders to paradise upon imagery may achieve a certain height, as did the builders of Babel, and they may enjoy moments of rest along the way, but ultimately they are doomed to linguistic confusion. This is a gloomy picture. The key to any hope may be in the individual writer's attitude toward the poetic image. If we are trying to make the word more than it is, if we are literally trying to invest it with its own life and engendering power, if for us the existence of the poetic image is itself a sign of divine absence and the conscious use of poetic imagery and admission of this absence, if, in short, the 18th century and its romantic reversal have left us with nothing worth worshipping but the work of our own hands, then our attitude towards our work becomes idolatrous. Words may bloom upon the page. They may even be seen as a sort of natural object, since their written and spoken manifestations have physical properties. But words can never originate independently of humans like the voice of flowers. If we have failed to recognize the arbitrary nature of language and have tried to endow the signifier with the life of the referent, words have become not a symbolic and powerful manifestation of that life, but usurpers which would bypass the original and natural concrete object. But if, as writers, we are able to focus upon the beauty we create as a manifestation of the transcendent and not as the transcendent itself, If for us the poetic image exists because of the divine creative presence, if through us that presence is refracted according to our own creative structure and our relationship with language and the universe, if we do not invert the source of light by fixing its point of origin within the word instead of external to it, if we can see our own gift as a natural object which we enjoyed but did not create, then we may be able to bridle our words that they may serve us and shine with the glory of snow which is full of roses, which is an image from Hölderlin, the original poet. The perennial problem of deducing what the writer intended from what the writer produced presents itself with unusual urgency in the case of the autograph manuscript, The Book of Sparrows, because of the surprising format of what seems to be Gustavo Adolfo Bécquer's final version of the work. And while intent can never override content, putting oneself in the writer's shoes may shed some light on that which says nothing but whose silence is impossible to ignore, the 509 blank pages separating the Stone Woman from the rhymes. Rika Brown chronicles the history of the Book of Sparrows. Bécquer received the notebook in which he wrote the work as a gift from a young admirer, Francisco de la Iglesia, who hoped that it might serve as an antidote to the slump in which the 32-year-old Bécquer found himself. He dated the title page June of 1868, and he wrote the symphonic introduction and the fragment, The Stone Woman. Time passed. With the September Revolution in Madrid came the sacking of the home of Queen Isabel's exiled minister, who had asked Bécquer for his poems with the intent of publishing them. The poems were lost. During his residence in Toledo after the fall of the government and the breakup of his marriage, Bécquer recorded the poems he remembered in the Book of Sparrows. Shortly thereafter, on December 20th, 1870, Bécquer died in Madrid. Just a little over a year later, the first edition of his complete works appeared. It included the rhymes, not as he had sequenced them in the manuscript that you have there. Do you want to take that manuscript back so the people back there can look at that? Thanks. But as his friends had chosen to arrange them. The manuscript found its way into the National Library of Madrid, where it lay until 1914, when it was unearthed by a German scholar, Franz Schneider. And little was done with it until in 1970 a facsimile version of the manuscript was published, and that's the copy that you have there. The story of the rhymes begin in an abysmally low trough. The first poem portrays a poet who has committed a reverse harikari, with results nearly as fatal as those of the authentic deed. This is the first poem, translated. As the iron is torn from a wound, so I tore her love from my heart. Though I felt in so doing my life was being ripped out. Will hurled her image from the altar I erected to her in my soul, and the light of faith that burned in her was extinguished before the deserted shrine. The determined vow still storms in the night, and the stubborn vision lives in the idea. When will I be able to sleep with that dream in which dreaming ends? The first upward movement results from the poet's reducing the agony that occupied all of the first poem to the second half of the second one. I have approached the deep pits of earth and sky and have seen their end with either eye or thought. But oh, with a heart I came to the abyss and I leaned out for a moment and my soul and my eyes were troubled. It was so deep and so black. In number four, the poet has climbed beyond bitterness to a thoughtful contemplation of the fate of love that is gone. Sighs are air and go to air. Tears are water and go to the sea. Tell me, beloved, when love is forgotten, do you know where it goes? In number five, we see the poet having ascended to the point where he can think about the world around him and weigh the options open to him. He listens to voices that promote love, glory, and liberty. The first voice. Waves have a vague harmony, violets a soft fragrance, the cold night silver mists. The day light and gold, I something better, I have love. The second voice. The aura of applause, radiant cloud, wave of envy that kisses the feet. Island of dreams where the anxious soul reposes. Sweet intoxication, that is glory. Third voice. Treasure is a burning coal, a shadow that flees vanity. All is false, glory, gold. Only that which I adore is true, liberty. Thus the boatman passed by singing the eternal song, and at the blow of the oar the foam jumped and was wounded by the sun. Are you setting out? They called, and smiling, I told them in passing, I already have. The proof is that I still have my clothing spread on the beach to dry. The poet is on his way, and he's on his way smiling. As he begins the voyage, what is the first thing that he sees? A woman. Tired from the dance, color inflamed, breath short, leaning on my arm, she stopped in a corner of the room. Within the light gauze that her heaving breast was raising, a flower rocked in sweet and measured movement. As in an aqueous cradle that the sea drives and the zephyr caresses, it seemed to sleep to the sweet lullaby of her partially open lips. As he contemplates the sweet sleep of the rose cradled on her breast, he expresses his desire for similar rest. Oh, I thought, who could let time slip away like this? Oh, if flowers sleep, what a sweet dream. Those who know the work of Bacon are familiar with his merger of love and poetry into a single entity. He follows the intensity of yearning expressed in the poem that I just read by a cynical statement on the crass nature of the poetry which is rewarded with money. That cynicism creates the breaking of a wave into a downward sweep away from love or poetry and into fear. You know and I know that in this life, he who writes poetry is rewarded with genius, and whoever makes poetry with gold. That bitterness prepares us for the caution of number 8. Then let us love each other much today, and tomorrow let us say goodbye. But as the poet continues to write, so the man continues his search for love. Cacophony reigns in the discordant clamor of the revel, the title of number 9, when he hears the echo of a sigh, a distant musical sound he has known before and known intimately, a sound which still lives, perfume of a flower which grows hidden in a dark cloister. He is not alone. She who is adored for a day tenderly asks, what are you thinking about? Nothing. Nothing, and you weep? It is that I consider sorrow happy and wine sad. Such a reversal of expected emotions portray a state far removed from any contentment in the present. In number 10, he asks a question, why does the lip feign laughter that the eyes undo? This is when he's come face to face with the woman who must be the source of his unhappiness. The implicit disparity between the expression and the feeling continues explicitly in I Know a Strange, Enormous Hymn. As he pled evidently unsuccessfully with the woman to weep, so he is able to record no more than a few cadences of the hymn that announces a dawn in the night of the soul. Were he able to possess the first, he would barely be able to capture the second. But to struggle is vain. No symbol is able to capture it, and scarcely, my beauty, could I sing it in your ears were we alone, with me holding your hands in mine. After having desired and approached fulfillment while never achieving it, the poet takes us back to the image of the first rhyme, that of the altar. But this time, instead of seeing the rooting out of love as necessary and committing the action not by desire but by will, his intervening experiences have convinced him that the destruction of the love was not only an unnecessary sacrifice but a pagan, idolatrous ritual. We gave reality to a phantom, a ridiculous invention of the mind, and the idol being made, we sacrificed our love on its altar. From a narrative point of view, Bacon begins the rhymes in media res. Something has happened in the 509 blank pages. We don't know what. The love has already been uprooted. We don't know why. In this poem number 12, What Savage Who With Clumsy Hand, the poet's deciding that he sacrificed that love to a false god moves toward the tragic. Is it too much to see the shadow of Othello standing over Desdemona's body? At the very least, there is a sense of the poet's despair over having destroyed something precious and irreplaceable. This poem, number 12, marks a change in the poet's vision. Up to that point, his quest was a search for relief from his sorrow. With the realization that the sacrifice was to a god in whom he no longer believes, his quest bifurcates. To his suffering from loss is added the burden of having made a decision he now decides was wrong. It's crucial to remember that at the time of the original decision, the motivation to commit so painful a deed, so painful an act of will, must have stemmed from total conviction of its necessity. It was effected not by desire, but by will. In fact, his now identifying the god to whom he sacrificed as false may mean only that the god was not permanent. There can be little doubt as to the sincerity of his belief at the moment of action. The dilemma of the burden of contradictory commands occupies a central position in both Greek and Christian mythology. There are a few intimations of grace in the Greek system, but for the most part, Attic eschatology promises condemnation to the hero who's on the wrong side of fate or the gods, no matter which course of action he follows. It sometimes seems that a large component of hubris is nothing more than the integrity of an Oedipus to follow his best light under gods who are distinguished mainly by their capriciousness. Prometheus, the only god who cared more about mankind than himself, has been chained. On the other hand, the basic Christian account of creation promises redemption from the results of having disobeyed one commandment, don't eat the forbidden fruit, in order to obey another, multiply and replenish the earth. Adam and Eve eventually received the rewards contingent on each of the two commands. They have children and, after passing through death, the eternal life which was at one point denied them. This, of course, is the basis of the pattern of fall, exile, and redemption which characterizes romance structure. If the structuring of Baker's work is to be seen as constituting a quest narrative, then the rhymes which follow number 12 will have to continue the pattern of search and frustration established in the first part. It seems that they do. Number 13 fixes on an old harp, a symbol of art, which, like Lazarus, is awaiting the command, arise and walk. The poet continues to see the unnamed she, at least emotionally distanced, in number 14. His wanderings are without thought, in number 15. He experiences emotional devastation to the point of understanding suicide, 16, and he loses his capacity to feel. Life becomes a dull, unsatisfying series of events. He approaches the object of his yearning, which he inevitably fails to grasp, and employs imagery depicting a desire for escape from the body. In number 24, with clothing ungirded, we see the poet completely barred from his desire. The tension between heavenly and sexual imagery established in the first stanza intensifies through the imagery of the second, with irons and double grills that defend the entrance. The central position of the third stanza, with the entrance veiled in dream imagery, recalls the centrality of sexuality both in the human body and psyche. Total frustration blocks the intense yearning of the fourth stanza, and in the fifth, the poet interprets the angel's warning looks to mean that only God can pass that threshold. Nevertheless, the creative act continues. Even as the pilgrim disintegrates in When I Look at the Blue Horizon, he recognizes the divinity of what he carries within. It would be difficult to overemphasize the significance for Baker of artistic creation, the force that holds him together as he transforms these intensely personal experiences into art. The act of transforming is itself the bonding. Words save him from the abyss on whose edge he is teetering. Artistic creation is both religious and sexual. It is religious because the artist not only imitates what God produced, he takes unorganized materials and, like God, gives them form and being. It is sexual because the artist produces offspring, as Baker noted in his symphonic introduction, and because his emotions are intensely involved. The equation of art and sexual love is explicit in Baker's famous phrase, "Poetry are you." When the poet is denied romantic love, it is natural for him to seek artistic fulfillment. Following the expulsion from his own Eden, this son of Adam is indeed multiplying and replenishing the artistic world. In sacrificing his love in the first rhyme, he chose to obey another value, which at the moment of sacrifice he believed to be true, but the consequence of his action is that he loses the paradisiacal state he had enjoyed before. He must now follow the tortuous path both away from and toward the saving love he can only remember. And for him, the road from paradise to redemption is obedience to that most basic of all commands, create. The image of the kiss occurs repeatedly throughout the rhymes. It metonymically represents the union Baker so ardently desires. The poem is this: for a glance, the globe; for a smile, the sky; for a kiss, I don't know what I would give you for a kiss. The poem's not naming what he would exchange for a kiss projects the value of the kiss into the infinite. From then on, further uses of the image, either as an adjunct to escape, a metaphorical description of a natural phenomenon, or an actual human transaction, stand out as frequent references to the poet's frustrated desire. The kiss remains unachieved through the first 78 rhymes. When in the night they enfold you, recalls the voices proclaiming glory, love, and liberty. No question remains as to what the poet would choose, but there is a question as to whether he is able to choose it. After all, is it not love for which he would give all? The woman of the poem appears first asleep on his breast, then in a contemplative and finally in a passionate state. Yet he would give everything he possesses, desires, or hopes for what? Must it not be the love which he appears to possess? But the tension opens the reader, for the reader, the chasm that exists between physical and emotional reality, which the poet is trying to bridge with his words. The tremendous amount of energy that he is expending is aging him far beyond his years. I have condensed a century in each day. I know that I have aged within. He retreats to the domain of flames, music, waves, vapor, and ideas. What he holds in the present does not fulfill his longing. Not only does the kiss elude him, but the word itself is not functioning as it ought to. A tear arose to her eyes and to my lips a phrase of pardon. I still say, why did I remain silent that day? And she will be saying, why did I not weep? In anticipating the fact of death, the poet expresses a compelling need to establish communication. I will die before you. All that we have said must now be spoken. Yet again, through the first 78 rhymes, this verbal intimacy remains as unachieved as does the union represented by the kiss. The image of aging mentioned above naturally progresses into an abundance of death imagery. The poet begins by wondering who will be with him at the time of his death, who will sit by his bed, who will clasp his hand, who will come to weep, who will remember him, who will close his eyes in death. He becomes a creature of the night, together with the cypress outlined by the moon, an outcast, a suspect, a companion of pariahs, reptiles, and granite saints. He predicts his tomb to be without words, solitary and forgotten. He speaks of the little life left for him. They closed her eyes explicitly deals with the pathetically lonely state of the dead. My God, how alone the dead remain. In contrast, in the imposing nave equates death with rest. Tired of the combat in which I struggling live, sometimes I remember with envy that dark and hidden corner. Oh, what a silent love is that of death. What a tranquil dream that of the tomb. I did not sleep, I wandered in that limbo, projects a sensation of the proximity of death. And I heard like a sad and slender voice that called my name from a distance. And finally, his last painful encounter with his beloved leaves him a dead man on his feet. Because your eyes are green, number 79, the final rhyme of the collection, stands out from the others as clearly as do its green eyes in a crowd of blue. She of the green eyes does not like them. The argument of the poem is toward convincing her of their desirability. Green is the color of spring. It appears in the rainbow. It is the color of emeralds, hope, waves of the sea, and the laurel of poets. These eyes, which are the green of the early leaves of the almond tree, will not spoil her cheeks, an early rose covered with frost. These eyes, which are the color of waves breaking against the Cantabrian rocks, will not spoil her mouth. These eyes, which are like brooches of emerald and gold fastening ermine, will not spoil her forehead crowned with gold. And finally and suggestively, with no reason given, if her eyes were to turn blue or black, perhaps she would be sorry. The plaintive cries and the unfulfilled longing which passed from a pleasant sorrow to a sorrow unto death find no place in this last poem. With the last poem, Baker cancels his membership in the cult of the melancholy. With the final entry in the Book of Sparrows, the poet achieves the peace postulated as his object in the symphonic introduction. And he does so with no loss of poetic power. In the other poems, the faces with blue or black eyes are more like mist through which bits of blue or black sky are revealed, veils which hide all but the provocative eyes of the Moorish women of Andalusia. Here, the veil has been opened. Now, if we add to the conception of the structure of the book the striking difference of the last poem, we obtain a sum, a whole far greater than any of the parts. The ordering makes what is not said as important as what finds its way into words. The jump between the last two poems spans an event of literally unspeakable significance. The abrupt change in direction, as well as the euphoria of the final poem, speak of that event's being the poet's epiphany. Words led him to it, but the moment itself is sheltered by words from words. We do not see it. We only posit its existence from observable phenomena, and that is an intellectual but also a spiritual exercise. Baker's conclusion of the narrative aspect of the poems depicts a pilgrim who has achieved the end of his quest. Looking at the literal level of the work, that of the lost love relationship, two ways of interpreting the resolution represented by the final rhyme come to mind. One possible interpretation is that the poet has finally overcome the sorrow occasioned by the loss of his beloved and is now able to relate with a new woman. This interpretation could be supported by the change in eye color of the woman to whom the final poem is addressed. Three reasons make this interpretation unlikely. First, the references to blue or black eyes occur in poems lamenting the unattainable, blue and of the sky, and thus they attain a symbolic value lifting them above rigid literality. The second reason involves Baker's treatment of eye color in his 1861 legend or story called The Green Eyes. This story centers on the irresistible and fatal fascination a mysterious woman with green eyes exerts upon the protagonist of the account. And implicit in the choice of green for the eyes of the woman of both the story and the rhyme is the sexual connotation of the color green in the Spanish tradition. In the legend, the green eyes of the story represent for Baker going beyond what mortal man can accommodate. The protagonist of that story, we have to believe, dies, or at least he leaves this mortal life. In contrast, the blue eyes of the poem seem relatively safe. The poet can desire and fantasize over them without being immediately destroyed, but he's never able to achieve satisfaction through them. The exile from Eden must wander long enough not only to bear the ecstatic vision, but through death or transfiguration to gain the power to transform the vision that destroys to an energizing source of joy and contentment. I would like to suggest that the green eyes of the final poem reflect a man who has been strengthened to the point that what threatened to overpower him earlier has now become his chief source of satisfaction and delight. As Pygmalion sculpted his Galatea, so Baker has written his girl with the green eyes. Third, a reading of "Because your eyes are green" as return to the original beloved is borne out by the structure of the rhymes. If we were to see the narrative aspect of the poems as constituting the story of a man who recovered from a broken relationship, wouldn't the difference between the highs and lows in the waves of words have to become progressively less until they approached a smooth or nearly smooth surface of equanimity? Instead, the opposite happens. When divine love is present or perceived of as being present, the sea is calm. When it is absent or perceived of as being absent, the voyager is tossed on the waves. Since at the moment of perception each state feels real while the other is only remembered, we ask which is illusion and which is reality. During most of the rhymes, the absence of love constituted the current condition of the poet, but he never forgot the love, and at the end it surfaces, becoming at that point the true and the real. The apprehension of divine love is, of course, at the heart of the mystic experience. The Spanish writers Santa Teresa and San Juan de la Cruz were both members of religious orders who transformed their mystic ecstasies into literature. There are three striking points of similarity between the works of these mystics and that of Baker. First, the image of death serves as the symbol of separation from the beloved. Second, both saints use the imagery of sexual love to express religious sentiment. And third, both of the saints express the total inadequacy of words to portray union with God. Yet obviously both saints do use words in an attempt to communicate their experience to others, and though Baker left his epiphany to structure, words comprise the structure. The mystic apotheosis, or union with God, epitomizes the skyward yearnings of Romanticism. But as de Man pointed out, because so many of the practitioners of Romanticism and their heirs made the word their God, they failed in their attempt, and their second state was worse than their first. San Juan cautions that one achieves mystic ecstasy denying his will and doing that of God, because ecstasy is nothing other than the soul's leaving itself and being captured by God, and this is what he does who obeys. and relieved sinks in God. Similarly, Baker succeeds in charming his readers with a nearly universal appeal while remaining a poet for whom writing is moving towards redemption, not redemption itself. Writing is words, not union. It is blue eyes, not green. The movement is absolutely essential, but if he were to fix upon the process, he would miss the goal. If he tried to make the word a flower, he would never find the flower itself. Baker stands as one poet from whose work the mystic heritage can be clearly traced. He underscores the distinction between the neoclassical, the hearkening back to the values of antiquity, and the romantic re-enthronement of the individual. In some ways, the mechanistic conception of a universe whose creator did not care enough about his creation to stay around recalls the gods of antiquity who did not care enough about their creatures to be just, consistent, and equitable. My earlier generalizations of the Greek and Christian mythic responses to individual reaction to contradictory commands is not an attempt to negate the insights the Greeks had. Partially equating hubris with integrity is not to say that pride and overweening desire do not produce clashes with the cosmos in which the individual invariably loses. But though that insight was valid, it did not go far enough. A new philosophic structure, one which viewed with sympathy the genuine pathos of the individual faced with the dilemma of conflicting powerful values, had to come into existence. The Christian gods superseded the Greek divinities. Romanticism superseded classicism. We have seen that in the Book of Sparrows, Baker was obeying one value and casting out his love while disobeying another. He then depicts a long and difficult quest to regain the happiness he thought he had sacrificed in the first poem, plus a satisfaction which is at no other point evidenced. This is neither a pagan nor a classic concept. It is Christian and romantic, and its emphasis on the redemptive power of love inevitably brings to mind the redemptive power of divine love represented by the mystics and evident in the existence of a savior in Christian theology. Why for a Christian is a savior necessary? Why in justice cannot a person who receives contradictory yet divine commands automatically be absolved of the consequences of disobeying one of them? Perhaps it is because he must be open to divine love. The experiences he undergoes as a consequence of divinely decreed disobedience are necessary precisely because they are so painful and so shattering that they can be healed only by a perfect and unconditional love, which love is apprehended by the recognition of a perfect and unconditional sacrifice. As Hegel said, the hand that inflicts the wound is also the hand that heals. And the healed product is better than the unwounded. The unwounded person was raw materials awaiting divine reconstruction, was unfinished or imperfect, awaiting completion or perfection. He or she has to experience disunity, division, separation from self to become capable of the union with another, which, like a metaphor, produces a third and new entity, the finished or perfected or redeemed person. Being perfected in this way no more implies stasis than the preterite implies less vivid portrayal of an action than the imperfect. The human soul has to be undone and rearranged if it is to gain the capacity of synthesizing joy from the disparate, sorrowful experiences which are its undoing. This metaphorical distillation of the positive from what appears to be negative identifies the divine creative element in man, child of the Creator, in the Christian scheme of things. To follow that creative urge, then, to make metaphors of words, is to follow the divine path through sorrow to redemption, and that is what Baker has done. But it cannot be overstated that he has recognized process to be more important than product. Poetry is not only more important than the poem, it has its own existence. He says, "Maybe there will not be poets, but there will always be poetry." In a later poem, he restates the idea thus, "I am that spirit, unknown essence, mysterious perfume, whose vase the poet is." Words are a construct of the mind designed to give order to experience. It is the ability to use the words to tap into the essence of poetry which assumes paramount importance, not the words themselves. For the pilgrim who beholds the redemptive vision, the world is never again the same. Those who visit the holy city may return to daily trudging, but having experienced the goal of their quest forever changes the nature of their journeys. Instead of searching for the object of vague and unspecified yearnings, they have now possessed a vision which permanently fixes their internal pilots on the redemption which, once experienced, can never be forgotten, and which qualitatively alters their future. As Mallarmé pursued his quest for the ever-evasive union of the knowable and unknowable, the azure and the horizon, he cried out, "The flesh is sad, alas, and I have read all the books." Ezra Pound expressed the yearning which is not satisfied through words in the eyes. "Rest, Master, for we be aweary, weary. Free us, for we perish. Free us, for there is one whose smile more availeth than all the age-old knowledge of thy books." Yet if mankind needs to experience division in order to arrive at unity, then modern writers, themselves the children of alienation, angst, and disunity, are in an ideal position to create works whose endpoint is redemptive. That they often do not may be in part due to the inevitable frustration of the desire to make living objects of words. But instead of looking to the mountain-centered strivings demand sites from Hölderlin, Wordsworth, and Rousseau for new directions, they should consider a book like the Book of Sparrows. Baker's late date, his fascination with the creative process, and his synesthetic blending of painting, music, and words in his poetry tie him to the modern poets. But if Romanticism, our artistic progenitor, is Christian, if its hero follows a quest, if it exalts the creative and divine in mankind, then Baker's work is also quintessentially romantic. As such, it may be profitably analyzed as exemplary of one direction which followed romantic bifurcation. While for Baker the word was indispensable, it remained a pilgrim's vehicle as he searched for redemption after leaving the garden. He created a work which represents the wonderful paradox that while words offer a ladder up from the abyss, focusing on the words as more than a tool, no matter how beautiful, how saving, how shining a tool, takes the writer back to the abyss from which they raised him. Thank you.
I can be brief. Ernst Baehler holds that the major ideological distinction between classicists and romantics was their concept of perfection, averring that the ancients, that is the classics, adopted schemata which admitted of human and social perfectibility. The romantics, on the other hand, multum in parvam, held that perfection could be found only in the movement toward it, and questioned the possibility of actual attainment. Fichte, in his Lectures on the Vocation of the Scholar, confirms the paradox and concludes that the goal, that is, attainment of perfection, is completely inachievable and must always remain so, because only God is capable of perfect mastery of the irrational. Man's ultimate goal is unattainable. It is not man's vocation to reach his goal, but he can and should draw nearer to it, and his true vocation, qua man, i.e., insofar as he is rational but finite, a sensuous but free being, lies in endless approximation toward his goal. Thus the Romantics adopt a philosophical system that denies the possibility of possession and unity, concepts inherent in the ancient or classical system, and struggle with the ever-elusive goal of infinite perfectibility. Such elusiveness leads most of Spain's greatest romantics to formulate a hybrid of the German notion of infinite perfectibility and Burle de Faber's view that the nascent movement represented a return to the Catholic and monarchist tradition abandoned by earlier neoclassicists. Donald Shaw suggests the nature of the tacit hybrid creed. Quote, "For the Spanish writer who, from reading or in exile, had become conscious of the old worldview among the intellectual minorities, there was no possibility of compromise and little hope of working out his own solution in peace. The choice for him lay between orthodoxy and the void." End quote. Rosenberg summarizes, quote, "In the terminology of the quest motif, we might say that the Spanish Romantic, having fallen from the paradisiacal bliss of perfection and possession offered by the classical model, wanders in an intellectual desert in search of a new structure capable of sustaining modern man in his skepticism of the promises of pure reason. At this point, however, the plot breaks down. The romance plot demands a happy ending, a closing of the circle, at which time the hero finds the object of his quest and returns triumphantly to either the place of origin or to an even higher level of existence. As Shaw indicates, the romantic longing to fill the void failed in Spain and left the pilgrim isolated in the wilderness. As a result, his pilgrimage was eternal. His goal always exceeded his grasp. Totality crumbled into fragments. His destination, usually well-defined, remained in the realm of infinitude. His destiny was one of infinite imperfectibility." End quote. Catherine's paper demonstrates conclusively that Becker, whose tone and style reveal thoroughgoing romantic persuasion, is nevertheless sui generis among the great Spanish romantics when he gets to the bottom line, that is, his belief in the perfectibility of humankind. He never could put aside his belief in God, which led him to infer that the circle could find closure. His careful and deliberate ordering of the rhymes of El Libro de los Gorriones to reflect the triumph of love places him more comfortably with the German or English romantics in terms of his philosophical or perhaps theological persuasion. Yet he was thoroughly Spanish. The paradox is clear. Spaniards have rarely been able to achieve unanimity of belief in anything.
Thank you both for your time and talents. Thank you all for coming. And remember, there are tapes available outside at the lobby.